Hey folks, welcome to RGCWV, Random Geek Culture in West Virginia. I'm your host, Alex McLean, and with me this evening is Luke Hersey.
Hey! How are you guys? So, this is a topic that we've been wanting to do for a while, but, just schedules haven't matched up and everything. And so tonight it's just going to be me and Alex doing this, but... that doesn't mean that the quality of this episode will be less than. Let's say that. So, Alex, how excited are you to do this one? What is this one?
Yeah, I'm pretty excited. You know, it's been a while since we've done any of these things, so that's good to get back in the swing of things,
yeah.
To do a podcast again. Nice to hear from you. Today we're going to be talking about late generation console games. We previously did an episode about like early titles, release titles. Well, this time it's going to be about late titles. What we're calling swan song games that, according to legend, the graceful swan, before it perishes, sings one final song before it gracefully dies. And that final song is the most beautiful and finest of all of its lifetime, and according to legend, it's an expression, a swan song, I believe that game consoles often have that one or two, like, cut above everything else, everything that the rest of the console has, and often bridge the gap between console generations. The game for the older generation being of or near the quality, or showing some of the quality that we'll see in the next generation, or at times even being superior than release titles of the next generation. That's the day.
Now, one of the reasons that we thought about doing this, I've talked about this several times on the podcast, but Ghost of Tsushima was a fantastic example of what the PlayStation 4 was capable of, and it made people think, well, if your hardware was capable of doing this, why didn't all of our stuff look this great? So, and that would be, in my opinion, a swan song game. And that is also, we're focusing on 8 and 16-bit generation. We'll do a second part that will be the later stuff. You know, PlayStation 1, PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3, PlayStation 4. We might actually have to do three episode. I don't know. We'll have to refine that list a little bit. We've only done the 8 and 16-bit generation, and I think we've got a pretty solid episode. Do you think so?
Yeah. We're going to do this. Probably this is a two-parter. I think we can do the later releases. Thinking about it, I feel like in earlier consoles, this was more pronounced. There was a more profound difference between early titles and late titles than there is these days. And it's one of those diminishing returns sort of things that, PS5 or PS4 is PS4 all the way through for the most part.
Right.
But these earlier consoles often showed leaps and bounds from their beginning to their end.
Now, one of the games that I was actually thinking about, just jumping into the list, one of the games that I was thinking about for this list, for this consideration, and that I had mentioned, we had actually found out that it really wasn't, but I'm going to go ahead and list it anyway, or at least tell you about what I was thinking. The very big difference between Super Mario 1 and Super Mario 3, that was a leap and bound game difference, like the sprite generation on the screen, it's depths of color and depths of field, the kind of the parallax movement that they had in some of the stuff, the overworld, it was all just so much higher. The only thing was, it's not really a swan song, it's not really a late generation game, In fact, and a lot of people, especially Americans, don't know this, but it came out in Japan almost 2 years before it came here. But that's how things were back then. You know, like, you know, a great example. The only way that you could watch Akira was a bootleg VHS right here. Yeah, a bootleg VHS. And sometimes there was different dubs of that movie all floating around. In fact, the one that I first watched, it's not even, you can't even find it anymore. But I'm getting off topic. But that one came out in 1990 in the States. 1988 in Japan. The Super Nintendo came out in 92. So that means it came out 4 years after the Super Nintendo was going to launch. Or 4 years before. 4 years prior. Then Alex actually brought up a fantastic example of an actual swan song. And this was the one that actually Alex thought would be like what defined the swan song. So that's why I said the Mario 3, because we're defining what we're talking about. So go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I do want to talk about Mario 3 just a bit.
Okay, go ahead.
That, like, yeah, it was far beyond most other platformers. Like, we judge these based on Mario, but if you think back on other platformers of the NES era, especially the continuous scrolling where, you know, you run left to right on the screen, most games, almost all platformers for NES did not do this. That it was always, you know, you get to the edge of the screen, and then there's a screen wipe, and then you get to the next screen. That's always the way it is. Mario 3 introduced vertical and diagonal scrolling in addition to this, and it was smooth. Nothing else did this before it. Also, Mario 3 had, like, the biggest hype, and I think people who weren't around back then don't realize how much hype this game had leading up to it. I don't think there was any video game that was marketed like Mario 3 was before.
There was a friggin' movie that marketed. How fantastic was Wizard? And you know, how much did you want a power glove?
Yeah, no, that movie is a time capsule. Gotta tell you. So yeah, Mario 3 is a fantastic game, but it's not really the NES's swan song. That is Kirby's Adventure. It came out in 1993, okay? Now keep in mind, the SNES came out in 92, so it had already been out a year, and they're still making games for NES. Something I've kind of learned about researching, putting dates on these things, is that generations aren't really a cut and dry thing. Right. They never have been, and they're not today, and we're in a weird time for that right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, especially with like a lot of the games coming out for both PlayStation 4 and PlayStation 5, or Xbox One and Xbox Series.
Right, right. And yeah, so it's just because the SNES is out does not mean that they just stopped making NES games. But yeah. So Kirby's Adventure, it came out in 93. It is the largest officially licensed NES cartridge. It's 6 megabytes. Which back in those days, that was a lot. That's, well, let's see. That's like 2.5 floppy disks, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, on a cartridge, and in 93, yeah.
Oh, 2.5. Actually, that's like, I think, no, because
about 3.5-inch floppy.
Yeah. The three and a half were
1.5 megabytes. But yeah, it is the largest NES cartridge officially licensed. The SNES had already been out for a year. Kirby's Adventure used a few, like, tricks of some kind. I don't know the specifics of this. I don't know how they're programmed. But they used some tricks to simulate greater color depth than what the NES was capable of. And it had so many levels. It had more levels than Mario 3 did. it had all of these different power-ups and sound quality.
That was the coolest thing about Kirby was the power-ups.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's if you go back and play the Game Boy game, you didn't have the power-ups, you know. Those were introduced in the NES game. Yeah, Kirby's Adventure, if Mario Brothers 3 blew you away, Kirby's Adventure is like two of it. And it came out very late. It was one of the very last big titles for the NES. And yeah, it's kind of the game that inspired this episode that we were talking about, that last fantastic game that came out very late in the console generation. So yeah, Kirby's Adventure, NES.
And
did you play this, Luke?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Right. Okay. I was hoping.
That is a fantastic game. In fact, if you are a younger person that may have not played NES and, like, say, have a Switch and have the online account, and you're like, which games am I going to play? You know, Kirby, Mario 3, and then, if you got time, River City Ransom. I will argue that one until I'm blue in the face. I love that game. It is fantastic.
Oh, it's a fine choice.
Yeah.
It's a fine choice.
I don't know when that one came out. We should have actually considered that one. Because I think I think River City was actually later. It's fine.
It didn't come on my radar.
Yeah.
And you know, the cool thing about Kirby's Adventure is that they still make games today. Like a lot of indie games and stuff like that. And even just the basic formula of Kirby has not changed since NES.
Right.
They still make games very similar to Kirby's Adventure for NES today.
All right. Do you want to move on to the next one?
Yeah. This was your pick.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is one that Alex didn't really play that much. And when we're going down through the list, Alex was like, did you play this one? And I'm like, oh my God, I played the crap out of that one. In fact, when I had rebought a Genesis, we're talking about Genesis. When I had rebought a Genesis, that was the first game I played. Not Sonic, but Vector Man. Vector Man was a cut above almost every other Genesis game. I mean, I'm sorry, Sonic was a fantastic release and showed that hardware, but Vector Man was so much different. It was one of those ones that was just, it was trying to do like a 3D graphics type. And one of the reasons why it was called Vector Man, it was actually modeling actual vectors right on the screen, and that's what Vector Man was. In fact, he was comprised as not one single sprite, like a lot of games are, especially from that generation. But he was, I think it was, how many? 23 separate sprites just made up of Vector Man, and every single enemy was multiple sprites. The only other game that I can think of that really utilized the multiple sprites for a single enemy was Gunstar Heroes. Yeah, love that game. And another thing that was really interesting about Vector Man was a lot of the games, they didn't target any higher than like 15, 30 frames a second. It was targeting 60 frames a second on the Genesis, which was crazy for half of the games. I mean, shoot. What is it? Golden Axe. Golden Axe is like 10 frames a second at its best. You know, that was what they were able to utilize with the multiple vectors and the multiple sprites. They were able to create better animations, not animations with actually drawing frame by frame, but actually using the system to draw that animation. Now, another thing that's kind of cool. Oh, we're talking about the release. This came out in 1995, and that actually came out the same year that the Sega Saturn came out. Now, Sega was always kind of weird as far as their releases, because they had the Sega Genesis and the Sega Master System and the Sega 32X and the Sega Saturn and the Sega the Sega CD. You know, it was all kind of a muddy release with Sega from the very beginning. But the Sega Saturn was the next major release from the Sega parent company. So they were considering that the you know, that cross-generational thing. And they had to add additional hardware into the cartridge to pull off some of the things that they wanted to do. And they were so confident in their game, and they were so confident on how difficult that they made this game, that they actually put out, I don't know if anybody remembers this, but they actually had a contest on that game. And it was only on so many actual cartridges. They didn't put it on every cartridge, but on a few cartridges, they put some code in there that if you beat it, it said you won $25,000. Now,
Oh, it's one of these
it's
contests.
one of these con but the thing was they were so confident that this game was so hard that the cartridges that they put out versus the ones that had the code and how hard they were making the game, they did not think, because I think it wasn't many, it was just a few that actually were the winning cartridges. It wasn't like a cereal box where you open it up and, oh, hey, there's the prize. It was, you know, the specific code and only a few or a few cartridges. And this kid actually got this 10-year-old kid, I think it was. He beat Vector Man. I've never beat Vector Man, but he beat Vector Man with only in a few weeks and got the $25,000. It really helped out his family too. They didn't have a whole lot of money, so it was actually kind of a nice story. But yeah, Vector Man, really good swan song game.
I've not played this game, but I'm interested in trying it, just to see what it is, to see what makes it so fantastic. In reading about it, it sounds like it was doing some things. I mean, remember, Genesis was a competitor to NES
Yeah.
for the most part,
And
but
Super Nintendo too.
and Super
It
Nintendo,
was
yeah,
kind of in that in between.
right, and you know, the not every. All companies don't just suddenly decide to cut off their systems either, right? At the
Not like
same
now.
time.
Not like now.
Yeah. But yeah, it was using like pre-rendered 3D graphics,
Yeah.
kind of like how Donkey Kong Country did later on. Vector Man did it first, so I kind of want to look this one up.
It's definitely worth the looking up, the research, or whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
So,
Oh no, I want to play it. I want to give it a shot.
all right, Alex, you had one, but this one I think is another example of like the Mario 3.
Yeah. We in our talks, me and Luke talked a bit. We were talking about Star Fox, remembering this as being just a game that was amazing for the SNES. It had 3D rendering and everything. Nothing else had this. Nothing actually
The
rendered
Super
anything in
FX chip.
3D. Yeah, they advertised this thing. It has the Super FX chip in the cartridge so that it can do what the Super Nintendo isn't even capable of doing. The SNES came out in 92. Star Fox came out in 93. In fact, for our previous episode, for release titles, it just missed the cutoff for being a release title. So, like, Star Fox is not a swan song game. It's remembered as being really fantastic, in terms of graphics and capabilities for the SNES, but the SNES did bigger things later on than Star Fox.
Right.
Well, I mean, they almost did Star Fox 2, but that's a different story. Right. But yeah, that's kind of a, you know, misremembering, misunderstanding on our part that Star Fox is not a late release game. It's an early release game. And then Luke, you said there was another game.
Yeah, and there was another game that we were thinking was late release. It was one that was from Genesis, and it was originally a arcade cabinet, and they thought about shrinking it down to put it in a cartridge, and that was Virtual Racer Pole Position. That game, fantastic. It's so interesting what they were doing, and it looked a lot similar to the predate 3D graphics that Star Fox was doing. If you ever had a chance, check out Virtual Racer. It's really cool what they were doing with it, and it's also one of those ones where they had to put additional hardware into the cartridge to achieve what it was doing. And it was further bolstered with the 32X as well. Again, not a swan song game.
Right. I looked at some video for Virtual Racer, and you know, it's for the Sega Genesis. It's kind of the Sega Genesis version of Star Fox, and it's the same. It's actually using 3D rendering and not some simulation of 3D rendering. Very unique and not common at the time, both of them.
Right.
Now, I know, Luke, you had talked about Harvest Moon.
Yeah. Harvest... Okay, so I know... And we're talking about Harvest Moon for the SNES, because there's lots of other iterations of Harvest Moon. The thing that makes Harvest Moon unique, not only is it like a swan song like time period, it was very much at the end of the SNES lifetime. In fact, it came out in 1997 after the N64 came out, or at least the same year anyway. Mm-hmm. But the thing that it was doing was the graphics weren't great. You know, so, you know, because we're talking about games that, you know, had the, you know, cutting edge graphics that, you know, was, you know, indicative of the next generation and everything like that. This one didn't have the high graphics. What it was doing from a programmer standpoint, it had to keep track of so many different variables that a lot of games of its time, you know, didn't have, like, you know, readily available all the time. So it was deeply utilizing so many different variables, all your vegetables and all your livestock and your relationships and all of that, all, you know, muddled together. And the fact that it did this so well and it never skipped a beat and never had a glitch is kind of amazing. In fact, it was so amazing that we have games that come out now that imitate that game. I mean, I know that they had Harvest Moon 64. That was a great game. That was actually my favorite Harvest Moon out of all of them, not the PlayStation one. But Stardew Valley. Stardew Valley is the love letter to Harvest Moon for SNES. And I think it's a fantastic example of what the programmers were able to squeeze out of that system. And it was a good swan song consideration. Okay. What was another one? Oh, yeah. What? Let's talk about yours next, because I was just talking about Harvest Moon.
Right. And the most impressive thing to me is just the year that it came out, 97. It's the latest. It's later than my two picks here. That 97's a year after the N64's release. Mario 64 was out. And then they made Harvest Moon for SNES. You know, that's impressive. That's impressive. And to me. I kind of have two picks here. They're a toss up. Hard to decide. One being Yoshi's Island, Mario, Super Mario Brothers World 2, Yoshi's Island. It used the Super FX2 chip, which was a successor to the chip that made Star Fox possible.
Right.
So in terms of technology, it was also it was a step beyond Star Fox. It had just an animation complexity, also a color depth complexity. It used a lot of sprite scaling and large size sprites that you wouldn't see anywhere else on the console.
That was the thing
before.
That was really cool, was they actually stretched and moved and grew sprites in the actual animations of the game. They utilized, you know, more, just like we're talking about how in Vector Man, they were utilizing better frame rate by actually using the mechanics of the hardware to move those sprites. They were doing that same thing with Yoshi's Island. They were doing some things that they just couldn't do with, you know, the frame by frame animations of the sprite building.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I was reading about it in this was a scan of a Famitsu article, I believe it was. And, you know, this is mostly pre-internet. Like, you know, these are paper magazines and stuff that was comparing its sound quality to that of PS1. That, like, when PS1 and the industry moving to CD-based games, moving away from cartridges. And at the time, you know, this would prove to be false, but at the time there was a perception that CDs really weren't offering anything that cartridges weren't, case being Yoshi's Island. You know, we can put higher sound quality on these CDs. Just look at Yoshi's Island. It has sound quality like PS1.
And why did they not do that? Money.
CDs are cheaper to produce.
Those cartridges, especially the cartridges that push the hardware, like Star Fox and even more Yoshi's Island, were expensive to make, and they didn't have any increased market price.
Right. So, right. And they hold considerably more information. You know, these were short-sighted perceptions at the time.
Right.
But that was the idea. That was the look of this game at the time, that it came out and people were like, why do we need discs if we have this? You know,
right.
That was the impact that it had. But my real pick for the swan song of SNES is Super Mario RPG, which came out in 96, a year after Yoshi's Island. I pick this one because it feels like a culmination of all of the amazing things that we saw on SNES, the pre-rendered 3D graphics that we saw in Donkey Kong Country,
right?
That it kind of pioneered that. Yet in Vector Man, apparently, you know, we saw pre-rendered 3D graphics. We saw the Mode 7, if you're familiar with that. Games like F-Zero and Mario Kart famously use that, where there's like the flat 3D plane with sprites on it. Yeah. It used that. The audio chip on the cartridge was a predecessor of the audio chip used on PS1. It was manufactured by Sony for Nintendo, because the companies were not always at odds quite the way they are today, you know? But yeah, it had a similar to PS1's audio chip on the cartridge. And it also used, again, this onboard hardware on the cartridge. It had a successor to the Super FX chip called the SA-1 that made Yoshi's Island possible. So this is like just the culmination of this 3D rendering and these chips that they put on the cartridge to make it run better than the SNES is normally capable of. It's everything. It's all of that all at once. And that's why I think Mario RPG is the final, last breath, you know, finest work of the SNES.
And then Harvest Moon.
And then Harvest Moon came out a year after, right?
Yeah, right.
You know, it's true. It's true.
You know, and I think that maybe Harvest Moon, I think that that probably had a difficult, I don't know the history behind it, but I bet you it had a difficult development cycle. Because, I mean, it came, its graphics aren't cutting edge or anything like that. It's just, I think that maybe, you know, like what I was talking about, the programming side, I bet you that they probably had a difficulty getting that compressed down into a single cartridge, with everything that it had to do and had to accomplish. But
still. Nowadays, I guess, like, space is barely even a factor.
Yeah, especially since, I can only get, like, 3 or 4 games on my PlayStation 5, on my $500 PlayStation 5 with a terabyte of space, and because the games are so friggin' huge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, thankfully, though, because most of the VR titles that I have on that, they're PlayStation 4, so a lot of them are, like, only a couple gigs. So I can have a whole bunch of VR titles on there, and but again, only like 3 or 4 actual PS5 titles.
Right.
And it's not just textures or whatever. It's also sound. But I mean, sound is actually a good example of, you know, these games that we're talking about. You know, the half of the time it wasn't so much the graphics that was pushing the hardware; it was the sound. The sound, the sound quality and the sound depth just wasn't achievable with the hardware without bolstering it in some way. So,
and there's a lot of technicals of that's over my head. You know, like I talk about these chips, but I don't know what they technically are. Just that
silicon.
They were better and they were an advancement of technology. Right.
They're silicon. They just took a regular silicon chip and then they took a little vial of silicon and they just pumped it in and then and then it could do more.
Oh, well, we tricked a rock into thinking. That's what a microprocessor
is. We tricked a rock into
is.
Thinking.
But
Stormlight Archive reference.
Yeah. But back in those days just having enough space to put your whole game on a cartridge was a big deal. And the fact that they put these things in 24 megabytes or 6 megabytes is that in and of itself is impressive.
Right. So, I guess a cap on all of this, we are going to have another episode with later generation games. A few considerations that we've made. And if you watch this, you can obviously throw in some new ones as well. We're talking about Tony Hawk's Pro Skater on N64. We're talking about Perfect Dark. What were some of the PlayStation 2 games that you were talking about, Alex? Oh, Driver 2. Driver 2.
Yeah. Driver 2.
And then Gran Turismo 2 for PlayStation 1. Because that was a late generation, and that was a really good game. And it wasn't so much the driving, but the simulation mode in 2 was fantastic. We hope that you guys tune in for that one, and we hope you enjoyed this episode. Do you have any other notes, Alex?
That's all my notes. That I had written down. Just look forward to, we're going to do newer console generations up to current day in our next episode. We wanted to focus on, you know, the old school
games.
We played when we were kids, right?
Right. So
we wanted to focus on the old games today.
So in news, this will be the last episode in this office. I'm moving upstairs. Bella's 14 now, so she's taking this space and turning it into her art studio, and I'm moving into a much bigger space, one that can hold my PlayStation 5 and a 4K TV and some VR space. I might have some VR content here coming soon. Greg who's on the podcast commonly. He's recommended several VR titles. I might do some VR stuff. In other news, I have to talk about this, Alex. And you know what's coming. You guys are familiar with conventions, comic book conventions, Comic-Con and WV PopCon. That's a big one that I really like. There's one down in Charleston that is focuses on tabletop games and video games. It's called DualCon, and they are going to have a panel on podcasting. I don't know how they got my information, but they reached out to me and they're like, hey, do you want to be on our panel? So I said, yeah. And they gave me tickets and a booth and everything like that. So if you're in the Charleston area in February, I will be at DualCon on the podcasting panel. And they've got some pretty good guests or pretty good podcasting panelists. One guy that does interviews with celebrities. This guy, he's interviewed like a whole bunch of celebrities, like Wesley Michael Shipp, that did The Flash on CBS back in the 90s. Okay. And was also Flash's dad in the CW series. He interviewed him. Even bigger than that, though, or even crazier than that, though, he had Ed Asner on there.
Whoa. Okay.
Here's the kicker. He did that interview with him like a week before he died.
Whoa.
He was like one of the last, like, media people that he could talk to. It's a great, great podcast. That one, I mean, I've listened to a couple of them, but that one was really good. I'm looking forward to meeting some of these people. I'm looking forward to DualCon. That's where I'll be in the middle of February. I think it's the 14th. I don't quote me on that. But
we'll have more information on the channel as that date gets closer.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Since it's an RGC episode, we're gonna do geek outs. Alex, do you have one?
I'm kind of torn between two things.
Okay.
I'll give you two real quick. All of this talk about older games has kind of got me back into playing my favorite NES game, Punch-Out. I want to get, like, good, technically good, and really understand Punch-Out and how to beat every guy and stuff. You know, I'm pretty good at the game, but I feel like I'm not, I'm kind of winging it most of the time.
When we were doing research on this, you said something that was interesting about Punch-Out. It was something about the sprites.
Yeah, it's another game that uses multiple sprites. Most of the bad guys are two or three different sprites because the NES can't render one sprite that large.
That's it. That's
but
what it is.
Yeah. There's a lot of tricks that I just never knew. I've been looking up, reading about it.
Hmm.
So Punch-Out. But my other geek out is this game that just came out for Nintendo Switch, Live Alive. It's a weird title, but not the weirdest to come from Squaresoft.
That one was exclusive to Japan, right?
Right. This is a remake of an SNES game that came out Japan exclusive, never came to the US. This is just porting that game to the Switch and updating it with a lot of modern graphics, similar to that of Octopath Traveler. Now, okay, I'm going to say it doesn't look as beautiful as Octopath Traveler does, but it's a big, big update from an SNES game. And to describe it, it feels like some combination of like Chrono Trigger, Earthbound, and Final Fantasy, and Octopath Traveler, that it really I have to feel like Octopath is in some way drawing a lot of inspiration from this Live Alive game from like 20 years ago. But yeah, it's definitely a mashup of those three, for sure. Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's out now for Switch. Play Live Alive. It's separated out into 8 different chapters, just like Octopath, in different time periods, different eras, from cavemen and prehistory to knights of medieval times and futuristic laser guys. And it's an RPG. They're all self-contained stories, but I'm told that they're interconnected in ways. They're interconnected, and there's like a final chapter that goes beyond that more episodic format. Haven't got there yet, but yeah, I'm having a lot of fun with it. It's a real throwback.
So, thank you for that.
Yours?
I actually have. Well, I was going to do one on Swordsman, which is a fantastic game for. It's for VR. I'm playing it on PSVR, but it's on other VR platforms. That's a lot of fun. So look that one up. It's basically a sword fighting game with real world physics. But that's not my geek out. My geek out is actually Mr. Bean.
Okay. Go on.
Sometimes I have to throw everybody through a loop. Okay, so I grew up on Mr. Bean. I loved Mr. Bean. I loved how PBS would have these British shows that were just fantastic, you know, like Doctor Who and everything. But Mr. Bean, I loved Mr. Bean. It just I was just something about his humor that Rowan Atkinson's humor that just really struck me. The reason why I started rewatching it, though, because I'm rewatching it. The reason why I started rewatching it on Hulu, it's on Hulu, all of them, is because he's got a new movie coming out that's actually based off of one of the skits that he had in Mr. Bean, which is Man versus Bee. It's this whole movie where he's trying to kill this bee while he's house sitting, and some of the actual things that happens in the movie, which I haven't seen the movie yet. I don't even know. I don't think it's out yet. But some of the things is stuff that he did in the skit that they just, it's almost like they took a skit straight from Mr. Bean and turned it into a whole feature length movie. I've seen the trailers and stuff. It looks fantastic. But it just, it made me want to rewatch the Mr. Bean series. Rowan Atkinson's a genius. He'll always be a genius to me. The Rowan Atkinson Live, Blackadder, Thin Blue Line. They're just, Rowan Atkinson's fantastic, but even more so, Mr. Bean was fantastic. That's my geek out. So.
That's a good one. That's a good one. I love it. I love these kind of geek outs.
That's kind of, we talk about video games on here a lot. But it's this podcast is not supposed to be just about video games. I mean, shoot, we did a whole episode just about gardening and fermenting. Right. So another episode we did on just on survival tactics in a post-apocalyptic situation. Actually, we've had two gardening episodes, actually, because we had the one with Lance Murray, and we had the one with that me and you did. But that one was fun. I liked that one a lot. Yeah. Any other notes before we sign off?
I think that's today.
Okay,
I'm good.
Well, this has been RGCWV, Random Geek Culture in West Virginia. Your host today was Alex McLean. This was his brainchild. And co-host, me, Luke Hersey. If you like this episode, please give me a like. Subscribe to the channel if you haven't already, if this is your first time. Also, if there's any games that we missed that you really think that we should have considered, please leave that in comments down below. As always, these video podcasts on YouTube are also available in audio form off of Anchor or all the other audio platforms that it publishes to, so Stitcher, Breaker, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. There's too many that I can even list. Support the channel in any way you can. Just listen and let us know how what you think. If you like the video, if you comment on the video, the algorithm likes engagement, and so it'll suggest it to somebody else. So anyway,
more than that, we want to hear from you.
Right. I mean, this should be a community effort, you know, Geeks United.
Yeah.
So anyway, welcome to the end.
Welcome to the